It requires structural fixes, and it requires people who have been born into, say, being colonists or colonizing others actively. This is an active colonization process, you know, and an active occupation, and it's a military one. We saw that at Standing Rock, right? That they have to really, Americans really need to ask themselves, and you know, I don't include Black Americans in this, of course, as well, because they did not come here as colonists. You know what I mean, and we need to actually sit down and renegotiate this relationship, and we can do this. I mean, there are other countries that have done it. I mean, what republic is France on? I mean, countries can sit down and rewrite their republic, you know, the very basis of it, and not the basis, but you know, the nature of it. It's not unknown. We're still on sort of democracy 1.0. You know, we can sit down and we can do this.
Well, on that sweeping note, we are going to have to call it an hour. Thank you again, once again, so much, Jacqueline Keeler, Dene Dakota, a member, and Dene, tribal member, and local journalist and author, and regular Second Wednesday host. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Paul.
Gotta go. Bye, everybody.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community, focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Hi, welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. A recent analysis by the Oregonian Live shows that there will be major differences in how much in-person instruction students receive by the end of the school year. That's just part of the confusion. It's back to school time, or is it back to school time? And what kind of school are people going back to? You know, our governor, along with experts in education, say in-person learning is best for students for many reasons. According to the Oregonian newspaper, there were hardly any students in any classrooms for any period of time last December. Now that elementary schools have reopened, about half our state students have some in-person education time. According to polling by the Oregon Research and Values Center, a majority, 58%, of Oregonians expect remote learning for K-12 students to continue for a few years, but only on a temporary basis, compared with 12% who think it will be permanent and 22% who expect online classes to shut down soon. What does all this mean for students, staff, and our community? Today, we want to look at just what has been happening in our schools, what's happening now in Washington County schools, and what we might expect as our future unfolds with such a distinct lack of clarity. Our guests today will help us with that. We are pleased to welcome Chris Damiano, who serves as Social Learning Coordinator for Beaverton School District Student Services, and also Christopher Keller, who teaches language arts, speech communications, and also runs something called the Strategy Games Club at Liberty High School. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. Moving directly to our question. Our county's educational priorities generally seem pretty clear. Pandemics can and do impact those priorities. I'm wondering, how have your professional roles, teaching and in student services, your roles, your tasks, and priorities been impacted by COVID? Chris, would you like to answer first?
Sure. Thanks, Rob, for having both Christopher and I on today. The mission and the vision of my role hasn't changed at all as supporting students. It just took on a different form and had more variables of a complexity. But the social emotional learning of students is still the key. And I'm part of a behavioral health and wellness team that's made up of social workers and counselors, nurses. And while the students weren't with us physically, we still were reaching out to them with school-based teams to make sure that the students and families had their basic needs met, that their social emotional needs were being developed the best we can. So in a nutshell, the vision and mission hasn't changed. And as we come back to in-person, we're just shifting as best we can back to what we know.
Excellent. I might ask, how successful were you when you had to reach out to those students? Were you able to find them? Because, you know, they're in their homes, they're where they should be, or maybe they're not in their homes. I'm wondering if you were able to provide meals for those folks who were in the system dependent upon them. Just a quick hit on that, please.
Yeah, in the pandemic exacerbated opportunity gaps everywhere, including yes. basic needs, including medical, and education was no different. And we were fortunate in the Beaverton District to have established these school-based teams and a communication line. So the school-based team of behavioral health and wellness was made up of coaches, counselors, social workers, principal, and they were able to coordinate on a school level how to outreach. And we were able to meet a lot of the family's basic needs. We would collect data, and we still are collecting data on a regular basis for how successful those outreaches were. And just so that you understand, like, the data that we were collecting actually directly impacted where we were directing funds. So our community outreach program within our district was funding sure. Basic needs. So we would go to families with things as such as even gift cards to get to families. So you had a spectrum of success, but I would say that the vast majority of families we were able to engage in some form or fashion by reaching out and going to them.
Just like the restaurants that were able to pivot to takeout, you guys kind of pivoted to outreach or greater outreach. Christopher, what about you? Same question. Did the pandemic have an impact on your role, your tasks, or your priorities?
Yeah, once again, thank you also for having me on the show. It's a good company. And I just wanna echo what Chris said about the mission and the vision not changing. That's absolutely correct. But I also, Rob, what you said about pivoting, my role has been impacted by essentially a year of regular pivots from, you know, increased hand washing before the schools closed down to sure. closing down schools, and within a week adapting to a completely different form of educating and building relationships with students.
You know, Washington County began reacting to COVID, the pandemic, just over a year ago. As I recall, immediately, some schools stayed open, some moved to online learning only, while others developed some kind of a hybrid model. And then, of course, things closed, and scientific information and guidance has been fluid, changing as more is learned, and it's been confusing. Could you give us an idea how your school districts have responded to this point? How effective has the system been in meeting those priorities and the mission that hadn't changed?
Well, I think what's been interesting is with the keeping the mission intact, the change has come in how we deliver it and what the focus is in the day-to-day. Before hybrid and before comprehensive distance learning, it was very much a protecting the existing relationships and kind of buoying the mental health in the sudden upheaval of no one attending classes anymore. This year, we've focused again still on mental health, and as Chris can probably talk about, the social-emotional learning aspects, but we've tried to dig in more in the content as well and keep that educational continuity going. And with hybrid, again, we're leveraging that, but now we have the ability to interact and answer questions in person. Maybe students are attending now that had a lot of distractions or difficulties or other responsibilities at home that they are away from momentarily in the classroom. And there's a little bit more, I don't want to say control, but for lack of a better word, control of the educational environment that they're in.
Which and provides them a better opportunity, a greater opportunity to concentrate and to participate.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so that's it's another chance to really connect with kids and help kids learn that haven't had the same opportunity when they've been away from the classroom.
Thank you, Christopher. Chris, what I'm asking is that the models for learning have been confusing. I'm just wondering how, in your case, the Beaverton District have responded to, you know, staying open, having to close, hybrid learning, developing models at different levels for different grades, et cetera, et cetera. I, as an outsider, find it very confusing. I'm asking if I'm right that it's confusing, and if so, how you guys managed to deal with it.
Well, I would say that the baseline was that we were going through this collective experience together. So whether you're a parent or an administrator or a teacher or a student, we were all really experiencing something. Even if we were at different spaces within that experience, we were all experiencing that. So whatever variable or change was thrown at us, there was a constant both empathy and compassion. So the empathy of understanding each other and the compassion of acting upon it. And something, you know, Christopher was saying was, you know, that really kind of resonates with me is this experience has afforded us to do a lot of reflection about what kids' needs are. So in times where we would have these challenges and there was confusion, we were also seeing some of our own practices that were not necessarily the best practices, and we were affording time for students to be able to step away to meet their needs. But on this day-to-day change, you know, it goes deeper than just what changes were coming from the state level. You know, we would have, as Christopher was saying, one day we're washing hands, the next day we're completely gone. One day we think we're coming back in November, the next day we're not coming back until maybe the end of the year. Next, you know, it was such an incredible whirlwind that the confusion really, I guess maybe this is too much rambling. I guess I would make it kind of a simply put, all of the confusion was met with more understanding that when we are going to make these adjustments, we just need to be patient and understand that change is what's happening. Change is the norm. And once you wrapped your mouth. Oh, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that compassion and empathy that you referred to earlier are the keys to try to help groups in particular manage change. Sounds like the district understood that and did that well. But, you know, in the system's efforts to respond to such situation, I can't help but wonder what you guys have learned about the racial and economic inequities in our schools. Are there inequities in access to opportunities for those groups, for other groups like kids with disabilities, religious discrimination? In fact, what I'm asking, gentlemen, is are there really equal educational opportunities for all students in Washington County now that so much has been revealed and exposed due to COVID?
I keep thinking as you ask that question and as Chris was talking about all of the anecdotes throughout this that really illustrate it. Like I have several students in calls where they show up in the call, and this is in no way a slight on them or their families. It's just a reality of the situation. Some kids can come into video calls and they have a headset and they have their own computer. Maybe they have like pets in aquariums or terrariums or pets with them, like in the camera. They're very set up to be safe and comfortable in their learning environment. And then there are students who are using a district Chromebook. One of the things that I was really proud of our district in doing was making it early an emphasis to get tech to all students, wireless hotspots, Chromebooks. But maybe they're using a district Chromebook, which means many websites are blocked, including social media apps and ways to interact with other people online.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, my Strategy Games Club uses some servers for Dungeons and Dragons gaming, and kids on district Chromebooks couldn't access some of the websites.
Interesting.
And so even in a club, there's that inequity of access. But then some students can't make it to calls, perhaps because they are helping their three younger siblings get to their grade school calls while their parent works. Some students who are navigating homelessness They have a hotspot and maybe a Chromebook, but they don't have a warm place to sleep at night. So when students come into the classroom, a lot of times it's easy to not have those inequities at the forefront in your mind when everyone's in class and they have access to the resources that you can provide them in the building. But once you take that building away, there is no illusion of equal access to education. And then it becomes, if teachers support professionals and educators and the system, can it support and meet these students where they're at and still offer valuable education and socio-emotional learning and honestly support during this generation's most significant trauma that, you know, hopefully won't occur again in this generation?
Well, your comment, Christopher, pretty much prestages my next question, but I have to throw it out to you as unfair as it is to both of you gentlemen. Given these inequities and the exposure that they've had, what do you suggest we do about them? And I'm going to let either of you jump in because I can see by your faces that you're both chomping at bits. Please, whoever would like to go first. What should we do about these inequities?
Well, Christopher, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and jump in. First of all, you have to acknowledge it and name it, right? I mean, that is the baseline to any of this. If we're going to have to talk about whether there are or not, then really that's not a starting point. And I do want to just add one more thing. Christopher, really, something he said resonated with me, and that was that, you know, out of all of this, really, what worked well for students at learning at home was only if you had this intentional kind of personalized, like, sufficient resources at home. Yeah. You know, this crisis, it delivered all these parents into like a teacher mode and children into learning mode, and parents having to know what teaching and learning styles are in circumstances that mean that children are, you know, having to replicate these models of what was going on in a physical school with expertly trained teachers, and that was now foisted upon parents. That's a huge inequity in learning all by itself, right? Because if you
I've heard that from parents.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yeah. And in listening to them, it is so real, because it doesn't matter what your level of parenting is, if all of a sudden now you're supposed to also be a child development specialist and understand learning styles and understand what your child does or learn and how they learn best in an academic setting, that is asking a tremendous amount. And so kudos to the parents, kudos to our community and county resources for collectively getting together and doing the best we could with such a mess. But back to your question regarding what do we do? Mm-hmm. We name it to begin with. We have to name that racism does exist, inequities do exist, that the systems that are built currently are built white-centered. And so that uncomfortable feeling of like, well, it works for me, I don't understand why we're having to address this, needs to be addressed, and we need to come to an idea that if it's not working for everyone, we can do better. So for instance, our district understands these inequities. So we're bringing on board more nurses, more social workers to find more connections to county resources, community resources. We're bringing on counselors to help address students' needs more. But more importantly, we're taking this time as a district to really analyze the practices that we currently take on. So to give a real world example, we're adopting or in a process of adopting behavioral health and wellness practices for our district. So we're at like actual best practices that are research-based. Now, typically what we would do is we go through what the district has outlined. They say you go through step A, then to step B, then to step C. But we know that if we do that, we're just perpetuating the same system. So we brought in advisors that are, and these are out-of-district advisors that are specialists in anti-racist trauma-informed care practices. We created a cadre that is 50% BIPOC staff, even though our district is not 50% BIPOC staff. And that's Black, Indigenous, people of color.
Thank you. Yes.
And so we have to intentionally go a little bit off script so that we can make sure that we're addressing what we're naming, so that we're taking action on those things, not just admiring the problem. Yes.
Christopher, given these inequities we've been discussing, what do you think we should do about it?
Well, the first thing, and this is going to sound like a critique, but it's not. It's just an observation. And when we have these conversations about what to do, I think, like with the school board in Beaverton, bringing a diverse set of voices to the table is incredibly valuable. Right now, in this meeting, for instance, there's just calling out, there's a very similar ethnic and gender breakup in this call.
You can be more explicit than that. You can call it out. Yeah. There are three white males, and we're all bald white males too.
Yeah. Every single guy in this call is a bald white guy, and by and large, in our education system, you giving me permission to say that I just like cracked a little bit. In our education system, our like Hillsborough School District is what they refer to as a minority majority district, which means that the student population is over 50% students of color, less than 50% white students. But our staffing in our district is upwards of over 80% white. And it's even higher when you get into classroom teachers. So diverse populations of students are seeing a very non-diverse set of professionals in the field that we send students to. And I had a student a few years ago who was a very thoughtful student, always kind of looked at stuff from a different angle. And he asked one of my colleagues, if I know that I have to deal with racism from teachers in this school, and I'm required by law to go to this school, how is that not a violation of my rights? And I think whether or not we acknowledge or see racism in our schools, students feel it. And they're subjected to it sometimes for their entire life. And so what to do about it, I think naming it, absolutely acknowledging it, is really important.
Understood. Thank you. When schools reopen more fully, I believe that they will follow the protocols and do all they can to keep everybody, teachers, students, et cetera, safe. Still, I wonder how many families might keep their kids at home and for how long. Any thoughts about how to reduce fears that might keep students from coming back? Chris?
Well, reducing fears is, that's going to be a challenge for not just schools. It's going to be a public health challenge, right? It's the same kind of fear that, around vaccines. And we are still struggling with large groups of our population that are skeptical of the vaccine, being vaccinated. Really, what we do know is that for the vast majority of students, in-person learning is more effective than not. So that's a great starting point. But more importantly, it's about really like opening our ears and our hearts to listen to these families to understand why is it that maybe it's a misconception. Maybe it's a misunderstanding. And maybe it's something that we need to do better to make sure that all the students get back. So if a student isn't returning, really the starting point is what does this family need?
Understood. And reaching out to them to find out. Got it. Christopher, what do you think about the possibility of some families holding their kids back out of fear?
I think that, fear is a natural response to something as significant as the COVID virus. But I think that what Chris said about, finding out where that fear is coming from, what families need, is important. But I also think that we do need to keep an open mind about what we've learned through CDL and through hybrid, and that most students do benefit from in-person school. But many students thrive away from the school environment. And by many, I don't mean 50%, but a non-insignificant percentage of students. And I've found some students who have a history of, like a long history of behavior incidences and write-ups and referrals and suspensions and lots of grades of not, years of not earning credit, really thriving in this new environment. It's probably, you know, a baker's dozen of kids, but I'm thinking of this one student in particular, and she said like she never cared about school and she was always getting in trouble, and she has done amazing work through CDL. And I think families who want to get their kids back into the classroom but are afraid to, we definitely need to address that. But I also think that the school district's education needs to be ready to meet families where they are, because some students are, what is the term, immunocompromised. It is a very valid fear that if this continues, their health is disproportionately at risk. And I think
sure.
we need to be
or
prepared
their family
to offer
members.
That.
Or their family members as well.
Or their family, yeah, exactly.
Carriers and bring it home, etc. Gentlemen, whenever the schools reopen, and you kind of referred to vaccine hesitancy earlier, Chris, whenever the schools reopen, will students who are vaccinated be treated differently in any way from those who are not? We've talked about racial discrimination. We have a whole new opportunity for discrimination right in front of us. Will schools or school boards give any consideration to mandating vaccinations for faculty, students, or both? Where do the relevant unions stand on vaccination mandates?
Christopher, I'm a member of the union, but I don't actively go to the to meetings. We have someone who represents us, but I will sure. say this: vaccinations and the kind of going on the Dr. Seuss's stars upon ours, the star-bellied Sneetches approach, this is bullying. It's bullying, plain and simple. If you if this is and I can tell you right away that unions and school boards and staff and community members are anti-bully, and so that would be my most simplest terms of putting that putting vaccine into a them versus us category would fall into bullying and would need to be addressed through restorative practices.
That's nice to hear. Thank you, Chris. Christopher, what do you think?
I was the Hillsboro High School rep at large in the union a few years back, and from what I've heard, it's there's a lot of support for the individual ability to make health choices as a professional and take responsible action, and that there seems to be no plan for the district to require staff to get the vaccine. And they always strongly encourage it, but there's no tracking of teachers who are getting it or not. And I can't imagine the district having a higher standard for children in the vaccine than they would for the professionals in the building.
That would make sense to me. However, at the same time, it gets back to the other part of the question about if families are reluctant and if families start advocating for, you know, I'm not sending my kid unless at least 80% are vaccinated because my kid's vaccinated. Believe me, gentlemen, I hope that doesn't happen. I'm not predicting that's going to happen, but, you know, we're in a time where we just don't know what's going to happen, which brings us back to my thank you so much for helping us today to try and understand what's happening in this educational confusion. I hope our listeners feel better educated. I certainly do. And to those listeners, please and share my thank you to Christopher Keller, Christy Amano, for their time and their expertise. If you have comments about this show, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me at rob@insidewashington.org or just go to our website and we'll hear from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon.
Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you're at on Earth, whatever time zone it is, you're once again listening to Culture in Motion, twice monthly broadcast on terrestrial radio, KABU 90.7 FM, community radio coming out of Portland, Oregon, and KBOO.FM on the net worldwide, and on Spotify as well. We talk about the intersections between culture, politics, activism, art, and so forth. Myself and co-host Ryan Danley.
What's up?
What up? I'm Mike Crenshaw. Today we have a very special guest. We have Captain Lobo of the Brown Berets. Welcome, Lobo.
Thank you, comrades. Appreciate it.
So yeah, man, we will get started. I know coming up in the 70s and the 80s, I heard about the Black Panthers from Jump, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. So often when people would talk about the Black Panthers, if they were educated about the political movements for social justice and liberation of the day, they would say, well, you know, it's not just the Black Panthers. There's the Young Lords and the Brown Berets and the Young Patriots. Those would be a few of the groups that would be mentioned. So my awareness of the Brown Berets goes back to being a younger man and hearing the name. And I understand that the Brown Berets are a current politically active formation in the struggle for human rights and justice